It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Well, I don't see the point in waiting any longer, so let's bring her out. The star attraction, the one you came to see. Ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, Ms. Judy Gold.
So, it goes from the laundry room to a fucking studio. And I have to say, your staff, I mean, I've worked on a lot of TV shows. All right, not a lot. I'm like acting like an asshole. I've worked on a number of television shows. The camaraderie, the feeling of family, you know, the show always takes on the personality of the star, you know, and I've done so many shows where like this person is full of themselves and it's so obvious. You can tell because the staff is like nervous or scared or blah, blah. And it looked like it was family. Is that the way it was? I mean,
oh yeah, I mean, it comes from like the how when I started to kind of assemble the team. So I didn't know anything about television. So we right. started to interview people. So when I got my TV show, what I did was trying to hire people with experience.
Right.
So I hired people with experience, and I fired them all after 1 month because they didn't have it in them to try to do something new.
New.
They wanted to do something
the same way.
And I didn't like that. So I wanted to come and so whenever I come and I wanted to make them, hey, watch Jon Stewart, watch the Colbert Report. This is what I want right. the show to be like. And they were like, there was this, we want to do the same thing. So I fired all of them and I hired people who had absolutely no experience in media. I hired fresh graduates, people in college, people who were engineers and lawyers and people, but they had a good sense of humor and they were more aware about what is it like to do a political satire show.
Right.
And I hired all of these. So all of us were newbies. So we're all of these people that kind of like
so
coming.
Great.
I knew nothing about television and they knew nothing about television. But all we had was one thing is passion. We had passion about doing something new. And it was a trial and error every week, a trial and error every show, every episode. And it was wonderful because we wanted to create something that we would like to watch. So
that's so brilliant. That is so brilliant. It was like, no, we're doing something new, which means not you, you know. When you first started the show, the very beginning, what was it? 40% of the population was watching?
No. No, the first year of the show, it was a small show. So that my first TV year, it was a small show on a recorded studio. And we didn't have enough budget or money to
right.
do the Daily Show version. We did a kind of a watered down, very low budget show.
Yeah.
And then after the first season, I said, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to do a live show with live audience,
right. yes.
a live
yes.
theater. And people told me like, you can't do that. Nobody can do that. That is
right.
like something that is different. Nobody does that in Egypt. Why
right.
do you want to do something different? Said, no, I want to do like the Daily Show. So that I had like in between seasons, I went to the United States and I shadowed the Jon Stewart team.
Yep.
And it was interesting because I didn't know he knew about me. His team knew about me. So I was like, you know, shadowing them. And then all I wanted from that is just to have a picture with him. If I have a picture with him, I don't know. I don't want anything else. But then as I was there, I find that his assistant coming to me and said, like, John wants to meet with you. So I went in and I thought it would be a kind of like a 5 minutes meet and greet. It turned out to be like a 90 minutes conversation.
Wow.
I sat in his office and we just talked about everything. And I didn't realize that like he knew about me. And I think I kind of had, I contributed in that, because when things like the Daily Beast or like, you know, the New York Times was starting to interview me at the beginning of the revolution, I kind of plugged John Stewart's name in every single interview.
Right. Yeah.
I want to be like John. I watch right. John. I eat him three times a day. You know, it's right. like, it's like John. So, and it worked, because the first ever headline of an English publication about me was the Daily Beast, and it read, the John Stewart of the Nile.
Right. Like,
yes, I made it. So he knew about me. So after this conversation, I was over the moon. It's like, it couldn't get better. Then after like half an hour, his assistant came to me and said, like, John is asking me, would you like to be on his show? I was like, oh my God, I'll be on his show. So on the show, and he asked me on the show, what do you want to do with the show? And I said, like, in a year from now, I want to be on a live show, having a theater like you and live audience like you. And right. I want you to be proud of me. And a year later, he came on my show.
Yes.
And he came to my theater. And that was the validation. And people can see it on YouTube. When he appeared on stage, the standing ovation that he has received,
right.
people continued to clap for him for 2 minutes. He said, I couldn't imagine that one day a short Jewish guy from Jersey would be received like this in the middle of Cairo. And for me, that is the validation, to be right. on the show of your idol on one thing, but to host him on your show on something else. For yeah. me, I said, I told my teams, like, guys, if I die now, if I die today,
no, I'm done. Yeah.
I'm done.
And your mother was like, now you have four more heart surgeries to do. You know, I started with John. We started, and I'm also from New Jersey, and I've known him. He's so smart and so talented.
He's genuine.
Yeah.
That's the word, genuine.
And I just want to say that John, during an award show, called himself the Bassem Youssef of America. So
he's the nicest.
He's all good. The show goes to the big studio. And I have to say, I mean, I've been doing stand-up since I'm 19 years old, and I'm 29 now. I've been doing stand-up since I'm 19. So it's 1982 was the first. Oh God, please kill me.
Yeah. I mean, 1982, you were just like 5 years at that time.
Oh, I love you so much. And those eyes, I don't know where the fuck you got those eyes, but they're really, well, I can't.
Recessive genes.
But they're fucking, they are just otherworldly, those eyes. Like, you can't, it's all right. Anyway, and I'm gay and I can't stop staring at your fucking eyes. So the show goes into the big studio, and the production value, the production value is amazing. Everything is fucking great.
Yes.
And you are, first of all, did you feel any insecurity performance wise? Like, cause you know, I've been doing stand-up forever. I feel so comfortable in front of an audience. Did you feel any weirdness?
Every single second.
Really? And,
I tell people, I refer them to the first ever episode on life. On the live show, when we had live here. And I tell people, I want you to notice how I looked like at the beginning of the show, and I looked and how I looked like as I was signing off and say telling people goodbye.
Right.
I was sweating. I mean,
really?
my hair kind of like fell down because it was so wet, and you can see sweat going through my shirt.
Oh, that's
I
so
was
funny.
Sweating. I was nervous. I mean, I performed. People were laughing their asses off. It was crazy. It was great. But I was so nervous, and I was sweating like crazy. I was sweating like crazy, and I had to change shirts in between.
Oh, that's so cute. You're so adorable. All right. So after that first show in the big studio, and you become this, here people are just, you know, the adoration, it's incredible. I don't think at any moment you believed it. Like, you know, that's,
oh, no.
And that was
absolutely.
What made you made you continue on. Like, you never believe, like here in America, everyone believes their press. Like, oh yeah, you know, and that's the fucking kiss of death. Here you are, your humility was so apparent, you know, that you were so humble and you didn't believe any of the shit. Like, that's pretty amazing.
And I came to realize there's a name for it. The imposter syndrome.
Right. So
I came to realize the term about, the term imposter syndrome the hard way.
Right.
And I was like speaking to people, I said, oh yeah. This is the imposter syndrome. I was like, really? So I had to look it up. It's like, oh my God, yes. I do not really believe that I am not that big. As a matter of fact, at the beginning of the thing, when people came to take pictures of me, I was like weird, not because I was arrogant, but I said, like, why are you taking pictures
of me? Right.
And because all my life, I trained to be something else, a doctor. I never trained to be funny. I never trained to be a stand-up comedian. I never trained to be a TV host. And then suddenly I'm big. So inside, it's like, I'm not deserving. I'm not deserving of this. This is something that I do not deserve. Why am I here? And when will this be over?
Right.
And when I will be exposed to the untalented fuck I am.
Right. When are they going to figure it out? What did
when
it
I
feel
figure
like?
Out that I'm not that great.
Yeah.
Oh, I was like, feeling like small and unfunny the whole time. I by the way, I never watch my shows.
Oh, I'm the same way. Cause I would be like, I couldn't do it. That's interesting that you didn't watch it.
And doesn't your voice drive you crazy?
Oh, I can't. Obviously it's driving you crazy too, but I hate it. I hate it.
I never rewatch my interviews or rehear them because my voice like is annoying.
I want to fucking kill myself. Like people are like, oh, you did an episode of this. And I'm not watching. Like I do not like, ugh, it makes me sick. What did it feel like to get your first laugh in front of a live audience?
I could not believe that be possible. Because you haven't understood, like, we're rehearsing the first episode. And after a while, having you rehearse, you tell people, is that funny? You think people laugh?
Yeah.
I come in, I say, I drop the first joke and the whole theater erupts in laughter. And I think if you even watch the video, I'm slightly taken aback with the first joke. It's like, ooh, we're doing this now.
Right. No, because I remember my first laugh too. And it's like, you're chasing that forever. They're nothing compared, you know, you just, and you, how long before you could read an audience? How long before you were?
It's, you never stop.
Yeah.
Reading an audience. You never it's stop. Just, you it's, think you can, but you don't.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be like jumping ahead, but like, later in the day, you'll know that like I left Egypt, I escaped Egypt and I came in America. Now you said you're telling me that I'm brave because of what I did in Egypt. No, that could not be compared to what I had to go through in America. Because I think what is really brave and stupid in the same time is trying to do stand up in a language that is not.
Yes.
So I did stand up in America and now I have a tour in America. But when I started that 2.5 years ago, I was dying inside of myself every single moment on stage, holding a mic, trying to do stand-up in English to an audience that doesn't know me.
Right.
And I think that is the most daring thing I did. That is much more than... In Egypt, I could lie on my language, on my own language.
Right.
I can wing it, but I cannot wing it here in America. That because people will eat you alive because that's not your language.
Right.
And I had to relearn everything. I had to rewire my brain about what does it mean to be funny? What are the rhythm? You're a stand-up comedian and you know, you can say a joke and it could be the funniest joke ever and you can mess it up if you delivered it in the wrong way.
Oh, right. So one syllable. One fucking syllable.
Or if the timing is not right.
Yeah.
Or
if you pause
too
for,
fast,
yeah.
Or if the pause is too long or too short.
Right.
So, I had to go into open mics in comedy clubs and I had to learn the hard way. What does it mean to be funny or not? And sometimes I would go even to a comedy show and I would kill it. And then I would, for example, go to a corporate event and do the same routine and I would bomb so
bad. Oh, please. Welcome to my world. Because you know why, Bossum? It's like when they come to you, you know, that's your turf. But when you go to them, when you go to a corporate gigs suck because they're like, all right, come on.
Yeah. Come on. And they're like in those, like, and they're like in these like hotel rooms with the big 10 seaters. And people are doing it in the buffet and it's like, what the fuck I'm doing?
I know. And they think they're so fucking great because they have money and it's like, fuck you. You fucking try this for 5 fucking minutes, asshole. Okay, sorry. I was getting a little Jersey on you. Yeah.
Hey everyone, you know what I just did? I tore, I poured, and I enjoyed a packet of Liquid IV because I love Liquid IV. Liquid IV is a major part of my life. And I just worked out with my trainer and I had a delicious lemon ginger Liquid IV. That one has a little extra. That has a little green tea in it, and so that's a little caffeinated. So I enjoy that because I needed it today. And you know, it's getting warmer out, and what does that mean? Summer. Oh God, please come. It can't come soon enough. And that means you have to hydrate. And that's what Liquid IV does. It hydrates you with benefits like electrolytes, vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients. And it has 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, plus 8 vitamins and nutrients in one little stick. And that's why Liquid IV is the number one powered hydration brand in America. Okay? And I love it. I use it every day. Ben's basketball team uses it. It is a science-backed formula that works. It keeps you hydrated. And they have sugar-free. They have sugar-free packets in white peach, green grape, raspberry melon, and lemon lime. Okay? I didn't do the sugar-free. Okay. But Elisa does the sugar-free. So what are you going to do? You're going to stay hydrated because it's very, very important. And Liquid IV has been a longtime sponsor, and I love them. And they are a quality product. And this is what you're going to do. You're going to turn your turn your ordinary water into extraordinary hydration with Liquid IV. Get 20% off your first order of Liquid IV when you go to liquidiv.com and use code JUDYGOLD at checkout. That's JUDYGOLD. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code JUDYGOLD, JUDYGOLD, can't even say my name, at liquidiv.com. Got it? You're welcome.
So the show, do you hear what I'm listening to?
No.
It's the Mitzvah Mobile.
Oh, what's the Mitzvah Mobile?
It's some fucking, oh my God. It's like some truck.
I know the Mitzvah, but like, is there a truck?
It's like these Lubavitch or these Hasidic Jews. I'm just going to ring the bell 100 times while I tell the story. And they are singing and they stop and they'll park and they'll be like, are you Jewish? Are you Jewish? Do you have Shabbos candles? And I'm like, get the fuck away. Am I Jewish? Look at my fucking face. Am I Jewish? And you're on the Upper West Side. Like everyone here is Jewish. Okay. So,
well I have a lot of connections with Jewish history because, you know, when I escaped from Egypt, you know, I always say, like, you know, I also had to experience Exodus.
Right. Egypt.
And, when,
oh,
I
that's true.
Yes. And when I escaped from, as an Arab, when I go through airport security, I feel I'm one of the chosen ones. And
that's hilarious.
I know. And then when I came here, I took United Airlines, which took 40 years. So exactly like you see how much we're connected.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
I you know what happened when we settled in Los Angeles, we settled in Fairfax, which is a very, very,
oh my
Jewish
God,
area.
Jew.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, that was like, my wife is half Palestinian.
Yeah.
Half Palestinian, half Egyptian. And she chose, like, listen, we might be at war with them in the Middle East, but here we go to the Jewish neighborhoods because it is the safest neighborhoods and they have kosher food, halal food. So yes, let's settle here. Let's forget our problems in the Middle East and we come here. We don't have to fight with them, but we're going to fight all over Hummus because Hummus, that shit is Palestinian. You can take the land, but you cannot fucking take the Hummus. You can't take the fucking Hummus. This Sabra shit Hummus, and it's like, no, it's not Jewish.
Oh my God, the worst. The fucking worst. Okay. Yeah. So, all right. So the show becomes this fucking, I mean, people watching it in the streets. It's just, it becomes so much bigger.
It was like the Super Bowl Sunday every Friday.
Right.
That is like how it is. Like life stopped in Egypt. People watch it. And I have to say, like one day people like send me a video on a coffee shop in Egypt. There were clashes between the security forces and the people because there was like a very turmoil part. And then when the show started, people took a break and the security forces and the ambulance and the people kind of like took a break, watched the show and then continued clashes afterwards.
Yes. Okay, guys, we're gonna stop fighting right now.
Yeah, we're gonna watch the show, and then we're gonna discuss it peacefully afterwards.
Yeah. Okay, you get a new regime in Egypt, CC.
Yeah. No, before that.
Right,
under
right.
The Islamists, it was because I had a warrant for my arrest. We were like doing our shit in the theater.
Right.
And we're watching, and then suddenly I'm in the news, there's a warrant for my arrest, and I have to go to the general prosecutor or persecutor, right, whatever you want to call him. And then I had to be led into this interrogation room. And it was funny because the officers who kind of like escorted me into the room, like they had to take selfies with me for their kids because they love the show so much.
And hey, listen,
I was like, can you please? And it's like, yeah, sure. I said, can you smile? Why aren't you not smiling? It's like, obviously, I'm not in a position that I'm smiling. I got to be interrogated. So I go in and the general prosecutor kind of like puts me on the chair. And, you know, they were nice and everything, but it was fine. And I said, like, why am I here? I said, like, well, you have to come here so you can explain your jokes to us. And it's like, it's the worst thing. It's like, I said, like, is this my torture? Because this is the worst thing that you can put in a comedian. And for six hours, the interrogation went, and I had to explain. They explained the jokes for them, and it was and people said to me, "What is the worst thing that we had to go through?" I said, "The worst thing is that when they were reading back my jokes, half of them were not that funny." And when I went out on bail and went back and I fired half of my staff, I was like, "Guys, you're not good. It's like I can't be embarrassed in an interrogation like this anymore."
You know, it's so funny.
The next time I go, they will be like reading my jokes to me and I'm going to be laughing their ass off. That didn't happen today.
That's so incredible. Because, you know, that rule that people always like, if I have to explain it to you, then it's not funny, you know?
Yes.
But, oh my God. Because Lenny had the same thing in court, you know, where they were reading... The judge was reading his fucking jokes, or the lawyers were reading his jokes, which was so great because they, you know, they were all filled with, you know, curses and, you know, they're putting in the, and did you ever in that interrogation say, well, you know, you got to kind of put an accent on the blank and then it'll be funny.
No, it was different. It was like, what did you mean by this joke?
Right.
And I would say nothing. So he would say, so why did the people laugh? And I said, why don't you go ask them?
that is torture. What? Yeah, can you please explain? All right. So then.
Or maybe can I have someone like this? Like, maybe you should have like added something to this joke, you know?
Right.
And then suddenly it's a writer's room. And it was crazy. Yeah. So that was under the Islamists. So the Islamists were removed,
you know, right.
It was like a military coup. And I thought I was invincible. Yay, the Islamists went. But then the military came in.
Right.
And they started doing the same shit, you know, fascism, but with a military flavor, right?
Right.
And I spoke against them. And I did one episode and I was canceled under the military. And then I stayed for unemployed for 4 months. And I went to another network. And then they continued to harass me, and then, you know, scrambled the signal, the satellite.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And they canceled me again. And it was interesting how the same people who loved me and adored me, being that I was like making fun of the Islamists, turned against me when I was making fun of the military.
Right.
And I told them, guys, I'm a satirist. I'm an equal opportunity offender. That's my job. And so that didn't go well. And I ended up having to escape after all of that, coming to America. And I came to America as Trump becoming president. And I was like, fuck my life. I think I have jinxed America. It's kind of like, and I was telling people, guys, I left a dictatorship back home and I came here just in time as you guys starting your own. What the fuck is wrong with you?
You must have such an incredible perspective on that, because, you know, it's so funny. He is a dictator. I mean, and, you know, you talk about, you know, Morsi leaves and then it's Sisi is like, you're like, oh, good, it's going to be Sisi. But then he loves the military. He loves the friggin' military. And so Trump is the same exact way, loving that pageantry.
I think Trump has always been looking at the Middle East with a sense of envy. It's like, why can't I just like oppress people? I mean, why do I have people like on my back asking me about my taxes, about what I've said? Why can't I just like put them in jail? And I feel when he was talking to Sisi or other dictators, like, tell me how you do it.
Yeah, right.
What's your secret ingredient? How can I just like oppress people without being, you know, questioned? So I think it's the first time in history where an American president looked up for an Egyptian president.
Oh, absolutely. And the Russian president. I mean,
yeah.
Korea.
Yeah, when you remember when he went back from North Korea,
and
he,
yeah.
I was joking. No, he wasn't joking.
Right.
He was like, it's like, isn't it cool to have a president for life? He wasn't joking. He loves to be there and adored and kind of like have. And here's the thing, speaking about like this and comedy, a lot of people ask me, what's the worst thing that Trump has done? And you can like speak volumes about this. But I tell you what was the one thing that kind of upset me. Is when, for the first time in history, for 4 years, he boycotted the White House
Correspondents' Dinner.
That for me,
same,
is a deal breaker. That tells you everything you need to know about this president. Yeah, because we had that president in America. I mean, yes, as a liberal, as a Democrat, as someone who's leaning towards the left, I can say the worst thing about like Reagan or George W. Bush
right.
or whatever. But they knew that this is part of our
like, culture. It's our culture.
I mean, not a single American president has missed a White House correspondent dinner except Reagan. And he was shot.
Right.
And he's still pulled in from the hospital.
Right.
Because it doesn't matter like how a dick he is of a president. No, this is part of the culture of free expression. I was elected by you, so it's okay for you to make fun of me.
Right, right. We are the same person, except you're really handsome and a surgeon.
No, we're cousins. Okay. So a lot of people, no matter how you think that the world hates America, they would still watch something like Stephen Colbert eviscerating George W. Bush and say, wow, I wish we can have this in our country.
Right, right. You know, yes. I so agree with you. On that point, the fact that, I mean, it says so much about, I mean, you were talking before about the small men, these small people. First of all, I say, you know, look, Trump wanted SNL investigated, you know, like you're a comedian. The fact, if someone made fun of me on SNL, I would be like, oh my God, I made it. Oh my God. Someone took the time to write a bit about me. Like that to me is such a badge of honor. When a comedian thinks that you're important enough to, you know, use as fodder for material, that is like really. And for the fact that this fucking guy is such a tiny little orange piece of fucking shit that, you know, he can't take a joke. He can't, because you have to have self-awareness to be able to, you know, to laugh, you know, and admit that you have faults in order to allow someone to make fun of you.
A lot of people don't understand, especially people who are like gravity toward authoritarianism, that making fun of authority is actually the biggest compliment
right.
to that kind of authority. Because even the worst dictatorship in the world would like to show itself as a well, we have democracy. We have freedom, right? But they don't follow through by making people criticize and make fun of them.
Right.
So actually allowing people like to be, and this is what the Islamists and the military in Egypt didn't understand, that it actually made them look good to be criticized and made fun of. And
right.
that's what someone like Trump that doesn't understand. It is actually like part of it, because those people don't understand the idea of being a public servant. It's in the world.
Right.
Even if you're the president, yep. even if you are the strongest person in the world, you're still a public servant. You are serving the people who elected you. But they forget. After getting the votes, they forget the servant part.
Right.
And they yep. and they kind of like get into embody this kind of like strength and power, and their followers for some reason revel into that, and they say, we want a strong man in order to kind of destroy the people that we don't like on the other side, the liberals, the Jews, the Muslims, the gays, whatever, you know, we want someone to take care of them, and we don't have time for a give and take in that's just like that's not acceptable.
You know, you say something that is couldn't be like, I just gravitated towards this. When you laugh at authority, then authority can't control you.
Yes. When you laugh at something, you're not afraid of it anymore.
Right.
And that's what incompetent authority does. They want to be respected and feared.
Fear.
Because they have nothing else going on for them. Because authority...
They don't have anything to back it up. Yeah.
They have nothing else because they are corrupt and they're not doing their job. So they want you just to be afraid. No questions asked. So that's why dictatorship and religious fanaticism is like two sides of the same coin. We want them to be afraid of us. That is the only way to keep masses in check.
Hey everyone, did you know that Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the United States with more than 10,000 different kinds of plants and over 2 million happy customers in the United States? And I'm one of them. You're listening to one of them. Fast Growing Trees has everything you could possibly want, like fruit trees, palm trees, evergreens, house plants, and so much more. Whatever you're interested in, they have it for you. Find the perfect fit for your climate and your space. Fast Growing Trees makes it easy to order online, and your plants are shipped directly to your door in 1 to 2 days. And along with their 30-day Alive and Thrive guarantee, they offer free plant consultation forever. Forever. I just want you to know that I just got off a plane and I walked in my apartment. What was the first thing I did? Is I came in and said hi to Avi, my fig tree. I'm telling you, and I have Yael, which is another plant, but Fast Growing Trees has changed my atmosphere here in my apartment. You don't need a lot of space, but they do have, you know, they have stuff for outdoor spaces. But I live in an apartment, and I'm telling you, Avi and Yael, yes, they're both Jewish names, Hebrew. The space looks so much better. And I just had a conversation with Avi. Like, I was like, I missed you. I love having living things here. It's very, very, I don't know, it's made this more of a home. It's the best. And Elisa has some too. And she loves them. And she talks to them too. But she got that from me. Anyway, check out Fast Growing Trees. You need to be around plant life. This spring, they have the best deals online, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get an additional 15% off their first purchase when using the code JUDYGOLD, J-U-D-Y-G-O-L-D, at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using the code JUDYGOLD at checkout. fastgrowingtrees.com, code JUDYGOLD. Offer is valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. You're welcome.
Your show ended, and there was, you know, it was scary for you, right? I mean, they're protesting. You said you feared for your family. You feared for your safety. You feared for the staff's safety.
Yes. And I had to end the show because there was no point. I mean, and even I remember like John said, like, dude, I mean, it's your safety comes first. You don't have, comedy should not be dangerous. It shouldn't be. Comedy should be a product of an evolved free society.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you have the freedom to laugh at things, you are basically liberating yourself from the boundaries and the borders that controls you. And the highest that you can go in comedy, the more free that society is.
Yep.
Making fun of religion is not a sign of disrespect. It's a sign of freedom. Because religion, like any kind of political systems, is an idea. And ideas should be ridiculed and made fun of. And if your religion is that holy and divine, you shouldn't be worried about
right.
a joke.
You shouldn't feel threatened by that. Like, it's like, oh, okay,
You shouldn't be threatened by that. And if you think that this will destroy religion, maybe you should leave it up to God to smite me or something. You know, you shouldn't be the agent of God or our authority trying to kind of like oppress people.
Right. You packed two bags. You got into your 2009 Nissan. By the way, even though you were a star, you kept your car.
Yeah, I kept my car. Yeah. All the producers in the show and kind of like became rich and they got their Mercedes and BMWs. I kept my Nissan. It's still there, by the way. It's still my wife and kids, they go to Egypt, it's still there.
Oh, never that's changed. So never amazing. I had an 88 Honda Civic that my brother had given to me, and I got on a sitcom and everyone was like, had these, you know, beautiful cars, and I had my little, and I loved it, you know?
And also I am cheap. And also, I'm partly Jewish.
You're a Jew. I'm telling you. So
I am, baby.
When you left, did you go by yourself and then your wife and daughter followed?
Yes, that's true. So it was interesting because the way I left Egypt, there was a verdict against me. So the way that they get you in these kind of, they don't get you on political issues. They get you on financial issues. They get you on legal issues.
Yeah, you owe them $100 million, right?
So basically, the network that canceled me, we went into court against each other because they canceled me. They didn't give me my money. So we went into court. And then suddenly, the 10th of November 2014, my lawyer called me and said, Bassem, we lost it. It's like, how come we lost it? There's no way we lost it. They're the one who canceled me. I said, like, it's a political verdict. No one can actually control it. But now you owe them £100 million and you need to leave right now because they're going to use that as an excuse to put me in jail. So the verdict came out at 12 noon. 5 o'clock, I was on a plane leaving the country and I never went back since then.
And was your wife crying? I mean, oh, your poor wife.
My wife was the coolest woman in the world. She said she was always making sure that I have enough underwear in the.
I love her.
And she was like, kept saying, "Are you forgetting something? Are you forgetting something?"
Right.
And I stopped and said, like, "Why are you so cool?" And she said, "Well, at least you're leaving. Other people went to jail, so at least you're not going to be in jail." So she was like, kind of rationalizing the whole thing. And I made sure to, you know, to back a bidet because I knew that people in America don't have bidets. And they consume too much toilet paper.
I know. I got to get a bidet.
And I don't, why don't you guys wash your asses? It's like you just don't wipe shit. You just have to wash it.
All you're doing is spreading the fucking shit around your ass.
Yeah. I mean, if you have shit on your hands, would you wipe it or would you fucking wash it?
Right.
So, exactly.
I'm getting a bidet. That's it.
You have to. So I had to come to America with a bidet. And that was the most important.
So funny. That is the most Jewish thing you've said. I brought my bidet. Did you fly to Boston? Where did you fly to?
Well, I flew first to Dubai.
Right.
And then from there, I flew to San Francisco.
How soon after did your wife and daughter come?
Like 3 months.
Okay. Was it? It must have been so hard. Did you know anyone here?
I knew a couple of friends that and I stayed with them for a few months, and then we moved to Los Angeles. And since then, I've been living to Los Angeles. And I have to tell you, I mean, it, the most difficult thing about America is getting things like health insurance, which is like, no idea how to get it. That is like the stuff. So, but like, I have to say the transition to America, like living condition wise was okay. It's trying to find a second start, trying to become someone that has a career in America. That was difficult. That was not easy at all. And I always had to struggle with the uncertainty. Would I make it? Would I be able to do it? Would I be able to have a second revival of my career?
Right.
And at some days when I would try to do performance or stand up in a foreign language, I would go home crying.
Yeah.
Because I didn't do so well. And I would bomb so bad. And still today, I'm still having the same anxiety every time I take the stage.
Right.
I still have, what would they get my jokes? Would I be able to perform? Would I forgot the words that are not my native language? It was very, very difficult.
Well, join the club. I mean, you have to bomb to be a great comedian. You can't, you know, that makes you so much better and stronger and fearless on stage. You have two kids now, Adam and Nadia. You have a beautiful wife. Unfortunately, your father died in a car accident. Which, do you think that was on purpose?
No. I wouldn't use that. Well,
okay.
Both of my parents died a year within each other.
I'm sorry.
And I have to tell you, my parents dying was as devastating as it was, but it was a blessing in disguise for two reasons. So first of all, my mom, I told you, she was what, this very strong woman. And she died before the tide turns against me in Egypt politically. She dies like a few days before.
Right.
And she died in her sleep. And my father died.
Oh, that's the best.
Yes. And my father died in a car accident. It was devastating. It was sudden. But also, they didn't have to live long to see me having to escape.
Right.
And having to not to be able to go back, or having like people turned against me. So
right.
they didn't see that. And also, both of my grandparents from both sides, you know, they had a very long, slow death of like Alzheimer and diapers.
Right. Yeah,
and
the worst. Each other. Yeah.
And I could, and I saw my grandparents going through that, and I couldn't imagine like how can I deal with it, with my parents having to do the same thing happened to my parents. So them dying so quick and so sudden, as bad as it was, all my memories I have for them as like strong, independent parents who didn't have to be dependent on any other people. And
yeah.
I'm here in America. I don't have to worry about an ailing parent.
Right.
Having to go through
who you can't go see. Yeah.
Exactly.
I know. So, it's just.
So yeah, I always want to see like the positive side of it.
Yeah. I had one parent drop dead and one parent long. And I would definitely do the drop dead. Instead of the long drawn out. I think you are so fucking great. And I really want to work with you. Okay. So that's number one.
I would love to work with you. We have so much. Let's do a show together. Like a Muslim and a Jew.
Yeah. A lazy.
Ostracized by their own communities.
Right. And I'm gigantic and you're, you know, okay. And do you feel American? Like, do you feel at home here?
I feel at home here. I mean, feeling American, I mean, I feel at home in America. You don't have to feel American, because what does American feel like?
Right.
I think we are a product of so many things. And I don't think we should summarize or reduce it to just being one thing, American. The
right.
good thing about this country is that you can be anything you want. And I think that
right.
is as American as it can be. Many of the ethnic comedians, I would call it ethnic comedians, meaning like people from coming from other, not white Americans, and not white comedians, they always make fun of the whole thing about like, where are you from?
Right.
It's like, oh, how dare they ask me where I'm from?
Right, right.
And I think where are you from is a valid question, and people should ask it. And I think we should not get too riled up about being asked where we're from. I mean, because I will always assume it's a kind of a curiosity. If the second question is, what are you doing in this country? Why don't you go back? So they're fucking racist. But I think like where you're from is a valid question. And I see a lot of people, Mexicans, Arabs, Chinese, Japanese, whatever, get so offended by that question. And they will always want to say, oh, I'm from Chicago. I'm from New York. I'm from Los Angeles. Like, no, bitch, you're from China. You're from Iran. You are from Egypt. There is no shame about that, because you insisting, saying, oh, I'm American, it means that you consider being Egyptian or an Arab as inferior to being American. I am Egyptian American, and many people are Chinese American, and you should be proud of being that, because America is the product of everything else. And I think we should be proud of where we come from while still be proud of being American in the same time.
Okay. Here's my question. We see the Fox News, we see the, you know, all these QAnon. Do these people remind you of the radicals in Egypt and in the Middle East?
100%.
Yeah.
Everything that QAnon and Fox News say, for example, let's say about something that is related to you, Jewish people, right?
Yeah.
For them, Jewish people is the enemy.
Right.
Back home, Jewish people are the source of all the pain in the world.
Right.
The whole shit about, like, you know, the protocols of the elders of Zion, the Freemasons, all of that is the whole, the same shit is being perpetrated and propagated where I come from. It's the same thing. You know, the same war conspiracy and the secret Jew and the whole thing. I mean, I was called a secret Jew myself. I was called like an Israeli who had like a fake Egyptian passport, who had to go in and infiltrate the Egyptian media scene in order to bring down the country through satire. So it wasn't lost on them that like my idol is a Jewish guy, John Stewart. And they use that against me a lot. So
I saw that. Yeah.
Same shit. Same shit happens.
Yeah. You're so fascinating. I love you so much. All right. So I know that I don't want to take up more of your time, even though I could literally all day. I want to come visit. I love you.
Let's do it. Come to Redondo Beach, where we live now in Los Angeles.
Oh, I can't wait. All right. But you don't want to see me in a bathing suit. So I always ask my guests two final questions. Number one, what do you do for your mental health? You know, because we're very pro mental health. Like, do you meditate? Do you, you know, what do you do?
I play sports.
Yeah.
Sports is my
exercise.
Is my therapy. Yeah. I exercise all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one thing I do.
What's your favorite sport?
I like just going to the gym and pumping iron, baby.
Yeah, baby. I know you have a really good body. You have a really.
I'm trying. And I'm also vegan. I tell people I'm Arab and vegan, which makes me scary and annoying.
See, you're funny. It doesn't matter what language. Okay. My last question, the podcast is called Kill Me Now, because I get pissed off at like every day. I'm like, oh my God, kill me now. I'm going to fucking kill myself. What pisses you off more than anything on the internet? Like, what makes you fucking crazy mad?
Instagram models who put huge essays on a butt photo. Just put your butt photo and just go. You don't need to explain it. You don't need to give some sort of a verification or a validation for your half naked picture. Just put there, enjoy it, and just say hi.
I know. I love when they're like, don't objectify me, but here's my ass and my tits.
Yes. And just like, love yourself and don't let anybody go down on you and just like use you as like, I look at you as just like a naked body, but here's my naked body just to make a point.
Well, boss, I can't thank you enough. Like, this was one of my favorite podcasts I ever did. I think you're so fucking smart and interesting and fucking funny, and I can't get a special. And so I feel like we have that in common, because I'm a woman over 50. And apparently we're invisible. I mean,
I'm getting there. I'm 47. So
yeah, but I wish you only the best, and I really want to work with you. I have to share a stage with you. I have to.
Let's do it.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Thank you so much for listening to part two of Kill Me Now
with Dr. Bassem Youssef. That's right. He is a doctor and a comedian. He's like everything. I love him. Anyway, Kill Me Now is produced by Laura Vogel, edited by Colin Schmeling. This podcast and my life would not be possible without the help of Brittany Jo Sowards. Now, if you like the show, I say this every week, just please leave a review and subscribe. Please give me 5 stars. Please, please, I beg you, buy my book. Yes, I can see that. When They Come for the Comedians, We're All in Trouble. Go to my website, judygold.com. Everything is there to order the book, to see all this brilliant stuff about me. Follow me on Twitter and Instagrammy for everything I think, do, feel, and love. That's at Judy Gold, JEWDYGOLD, you know, like Jew Gold. And this Friday night on FX, the new documentary Hysterical premieres, where I am a part of this amazing, amazing doc about what it's like to be a female comedian. And it's great. And Andrea Nevins, Jessica Kirsten, who, ding, ding, where's my bill? Jessica's a good friend of mine. She was also on the podcast. Andrea's a Jew. It's great. So check it out. It's on Friday night on FX. And then Saturday, the 3rd, it will be on Hulu for everyone. And also, I hope everyone's getting vaccinated. It's getting better. Slowly but surely. Happy Easter. Zissen Pesach. Whatever you celebrate, wear a mask. Hug your family. And thank you so much for listening. And as we always say, so long. Oh, they're coming to get me. Gotta run.
And everything was wonderful. I'll see you soon. Thank you for the visit. So long.